Well, it's good to see everybody. We're going to go ahead and get started with the class. I have enough trouble finishing on time as it is, so we're going to try to get going at our scheduled time, or at least as close an approximation to it as I am capable of. We're starting a new series, and the spring topic is going to be the book of Job. So we're going to cover actually three different books this year after talking about it with the elders and going over some things that might be useful. The handouts for today include, if you go on the table in the back, besides the usual outline of today's class and the little note supplement, there's also this pink sheet has a schedule for the springtime of our study of the book of Job. So if you want to be aware of what's happening, what to expect, and suppose if there's anything on there you want to make sure to avoid, that's fine too. The class for the year, schedule for the year, just for those of you who are curious, put it up on the board over here. The plan is to study Job in the spring, and then summer to study the book of Proverbs, and then in the fall to study the book of Colossians. Now there is something of a connecting theme amongst those books, because the idea is perspective. Job is a book written to give us perspective on the really troubling questions of life, the really, really deep questions of life, the things that people agonize over. Proverbs is, in a sense, kind of like an opposite focus, because Proverbs is written to help us develop a spiritual perspective on the most routine and ordinary things of life, to help us to see that even in the aspects of daily living, that there can be spiritual points to be made. And Colossians is focused on developing an eternal perspective, try to pull our minds off of the things of this earth and onto things above. So that's kind of the connecting idea. We're going to start with Job. We're going to talk about this concept which Job says in one of his speeches in the midst of all his trials, that humanity is just born to trouble. It's just a world full of trouble. And what's that all about? And Job, of course, wrestles with a lot of very important questions. So we're going to take a look this week at the first three chapters, which kind of sets up the whole book, introduces Job and his trials, and then we listen to Job share for the first time his perspective on our trials. And that'll give us more than enough to think about. Perry is going to lead us in a short time of prayer, and then we'll be ready for action.
Lord God, thank you for getting back together, for studying your word. Thank you for Mark for his preparation for his classes this quarter, and just look forward to what's ahead. Help us to contemplate what you have to say and learn from it, and live lives that are appropriate. We thank you so much that you reached down to us and helped us to see you and give us faith and allow us to know you. We just ask you to continue on with us in our lives and lead us to you at the end. And then one day we'll just be found with you, and we look forward to that time. God, we thank you so much for Jesus and pray.
Amen. Thanks very much. Okay, let's go ahead and just get right into the book of Job. Turn over to Job chapter 1. Now, I'm sure most of you are familiar with the basic story, right? What's the basic outline of the book of Job?
Satan asks if you tempt Job, God says okay.
Job is a what kind of guy?
Very godly guy.
Pretty good guy, and he's got lots of stuff, been very blessed, and Satan takes it all away. Satan attacks him mercilessly, does horrible things to him, and then Job is turned from this wealthy person with a great life to living in horrible suffering. And then at the end, we know God comes in and he kind of talks about the things that are going on. And in the end, Job gets at least a lot of his stuff back. But in the middle of the book, there's very extended discussion about human suffering. And that's really what the book is about. People tend to know the basic story of Job, but not really grasp or wrestle with the heart of the book of Job. You know, of the 42 chapters, most of it, the vast majority of it, is talking about the struggles of life, the sufferings of life, the pains of life. And it points out that it really defies simple answers. And so when we read the book of Job, we're going to find a lot of things that probably challenge our simplistic ideas about human suffering and about what life is for. It's meant to do that. It's meant to help us to see that there's a lot of things about life that are very troubling, and God is aware of them. God doesn't try to deny them, doesn't want us to deny them, wants us to come to grips with the fact that as wonderful as this life can be and as many blessings as God gives us, there's a lot of pain and suffering in the world. There's a lot of injustice in the world. There's a lot of unfairness in the world. And instead of trying to explain it away or come up with simple answers, God wants us to really understand that for a lot of people, life is very difficult. And even for ourselves, we're going to go through difficult times. Okay, Job chapter 1, we're just going to read the whole chapter here to get started. So I'm going to call on some volunteers, since everyone has kind of pre-volunteered themselves by coming to class today. You know the chances now when you come here. But the first five verses. Jennifer, could you read that for us? And then verse 6 through 12. Don, can you get that for us? And then the rest of the chapter, could you finish that up for us, Lloyd?
Okay.
And those of you who I missed the first time around, just remember that old Robert Plant song, "Your Time Is Gonna Come."
There was a man in the land of his name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. There were born to him seven sons and three daughters. His 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 female donkeys, and very many servants, so that this man was the greatest of all the people of the east. His sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one on his day, and they would send and invite their free sisters to eat and drink with them. And when the day of the feast would run their course, Job would send and consecrate them, and he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did continually.
Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, "From where do you come?" But Satan answered the Lord and said, "From roaming about on the earth and walking around on it." The Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? For there is no one like him on the earth, an upright man, fearing God, and turning away from evil." Then Satan answered the Lord, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge about him and his house and all that he has on every side? He has blessed the work of his hand, and his possessions have increased in the land. But put forth your hand now and touch all that he has. He will surely curse you to your face." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your power, only do not put forth your hand on him, but take it from it from the presence of the Lord."
One day when Job's sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the donkeys were grazing nearby, and the Sabaeans attacked and carried them off. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, "The fire of God fell from the sky and burned up the sheep and the servants, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, "The Chaldeans formed three raiding parties and swept down on your camels and carried them off. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, yet another messenger came and said, "Your sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, when suddenly a mighty wind swept in from the desert and struck the four corners of the house. It collapsed on them, and they are dead, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." At this, Job got up and tore his robe and shaved his head. Then he fell to the ground and worshipped and said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised." In all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing.
Okay, thanks very much. You'll notice that this situation is very extreme. Job goes from one extreme to another. And it's certainly deliberate on the part of the writer of the book to make sure we fully understand what a drastic change this is and what a sudden disaster it is, because it's a shocking reminder of how fragile life here is. It's a shocking reminder of how quickly things can change, how quickly bad things can happen. And when we first meet Job, there's a number of things about him. Job's financial condition is what?
Very good.
Very good. Lots of wealth, at least as it was measured in the time. Family, what's his family like? Big family, seems to be close, seem to love each other. Job seems to love them. What's his relationship with God like? Seems to be very good. He's very concerned, very conscientious, seems to be appreciative for what he has. Well, you know, a lot of times when you read a story that starts off this way, you kind of have certain expectations. Oh, a guy this good, you know, he's going to go do some great things and you'll discover a cure for cancer and all that kind of thing. And that's not what happens at all. Because the scene shifts to a very strange conversation that goes on between God and Satan. We leave this idyllic situation with this wonderful man and his wonderful life, and we immediately go up to see this strange conversation in heaven between God and Satan. Now, that, by the way, the name Satan, it's actually written in Hebrew. It's not actually a name. It's actually a description. Do you know what the name Satan means in Hebrew?
Accuser.
The accuser, yeah, and it's actually the accuser. So sometimes people in translating, you could call him the Satan or the accuser. That's what he's doing. It says the accuser came before God, and God's talking about Job, and Satan accuses him of what? What's he actually accuse him of? It's kind of interesting. He doesn't say, "Oh, you didn't notice it, God," but Job's been dipping into the till at work. That's how he got all that wealth. He doesn't say, "You didn't notice it, God," but Job beats his servants when you're not looking. What's he accuse him of, Don?
Of only following God, because God's giving him all this stuff and protection.
Yeah, essentially he accuses Job of a false faith, doesn't he? That Job only has faith in you because you gave him all that stuff. That's essentially what he's talking about, right, Dave?
I think he's saying that Job doesn't have heart. What he does is
official. Not in his heart. That
is not, his worship is not true.
That is not truly worshiping. That's a good way of putting it. That's really what Satan's accusation is. And it's interesting because he couldn't really accuse him of too much else, so he finds that. Well, the end result is that God says, "Well, I think you're wrong, and I'll allow you to do some horrible things to Job just so that you realize that this is not the case, just so that you realize that Job is not that kind of a person." And you know, this scene, I hope you understand, it's kind of stylized. That's to say, it's not supposed to be a literal description. A lot of times people get bogged down in, well, is this taking place in heaven or where is this? You know, did God meet Satan on a Caribbean island or something like that? Or you know, how is this to be understood? We know a literal description of celestial beings would be incomprehensible to us. So we're not meant to get bogged down in that kind of thing. There's a couple things that we're supposed to notice that have nothing to do with these kind of side issues. Is that the suffering that Job goes through doesn't actually come from God, does it? God doesn't initiate it. But on the other hand, God doesn't do what?
Doesn't
he doesn't stop it either. So in other words, it's two very different things, but they actually still present some questions. It's not as if God did it, but God deliberately told the accuser, knowing that he was going to commit horrible acts of vengeance against Job, deliberately let him do it. And it's a troubling question. And it's really the question that preoccupies much of the book of Job. But it's important that we don't explain it away. It's one of the things that really is difficult for us to accept the fact that God does allow a lot of horrible things to happen. And it's unfortunately, it's one of the sad ironies about Christianity, especially in our society, that the people who tend to be the most sensitive to human suffering and really wrestle with it, who really accept how awful the world can be, many of them are unbelievers. A lot of Christians feel this bizarre obligation to explain it away. Oh no, God's got a plan for everything. Oh yeah, sure, these horrible things happen and all these babies are dying and everybody's suffering that, but God's got a great plan, I just know it. And we tend to call that faith, but it's really not. God never asked us to explain away all the suffering in the world. God asks us to do something very different with it. And in fact, that's what the book of Job is about, is trying to get a new and more spiritual perspective on how horrible this world can be. Do you have a question, Dave? Or?
No, I just wanted to comment. One of the great things about our Father's name, his character, is that he will not violate his creation free choice. We consider that, then you can understand how come a lot of things happen in life.
And you know,
it just doesn't get in the way of some nut in a car that
And here we see that to an extreme, because who's free? Who is he allowing to have free will right here? He even allows Satan to have the free will. And Satan's will is very simple. Satan doesn't have a lot of complicated agendas. Satan's free will is described in Revelation 12:12, which is, by the way, is on the Frank Chappell top 10 scripture list. Revelation 12:12 is right after Satan is ejected from heaven. And you remember what it says? It says, rejoice the heavens, because we're through with this character, but woe to the earth, because now he's down there, and he's filled with fury. He's filled with anger. And as soon as the inhibitions on Satan are lifted by God, what does he go out and do? He immediately full-scale assault on Job with everything he has. He can't resist it. Satan's hatred for humanity is the reason for a lot of our suffering. The question is, why then, as Dave points out, that free will that he allows to us, you know, we like free will for ourselves, don't we? We don't like it for other people, and we especially don't like it for Satan. That's the whole problem. That's what makes life down here so complicated. It's not my free will. I use my free will very wisely. It's those other guys using their free will. Well, let me go ahead a little bit, and then if we got time, we'll get to some comments. When this disaster strikes, then, it's very shocking. And it's one of these things that if this happened today, you know, we would have this obsessive news media coverage. You know, some famous wealthy person going through all this stuff. You know, there'd be just nonstop coverage that everyone would be jumping out with their opinions and their explanations and blaming people. You know, you just have overkill from these superficial cable news networks. Hey, our first redundancy of the year. You turn on CNN. And they'd have this obsessive coverage, and you'd be able to watch the CNN special report, their investigative reporter who's been sent to Bermuda to do special in-depth coverage of the way the Job crisis is affecting the Caribbean economy. And then when you get tired of listening to that drivel, you could turn over to Fox, and there would be their commentator explaining why this is all the president's fault. You know, if he just allowed Job's servants to have assault weapons, this never would have happened. This is the kind of thing that's going to happen when you have a president who's secretly a Muslim. It's all his fault. Everybody tends to take these crises and disasters and tends to do one of two things with them. You either tend to just deny it, explain it away, blame somebody for it, not my problem, or you tend to try to exploit it. Let's see if we can use this. Let's see if I can help people to see that I'm so much more caring than everybody else because I care more about this. My solution is the best one. If people would just listen to me. Sometimes we might just worry about it. This happened to Job. Could it happen to me? Could it happen to me next? Could I be next? Look at the way this thing can happen. Well, see, the whole thing comes down to the fact that when we look at the suffering and the struggles of the world, we really want to try to take control over it. We really want to try to force it into a framework that our little mortal minds can handle. And as Christians, we are far from immune to that temptation. You know, we just want to come up with a quote we heard or come up with a lesson we heard that just makes it all seem okay, or we just want to write it off. I got faith that God's going to make all this stuff work out. And you know, when it comes to your own sufferings, that can be a very healthy thing. When it comes to your own sufferings, to be able to say, as Job does, it's a very sincere statement. Now later we're going to see Job takes a very different attitude, but for right now, how does he handle it? He handles it really well. He says, well, look, naked I came into the world, naked I will depart. What's he saying, essentially? Came into the world with nothing? And I'm going to have nothing when I leave. I knew I was going to get taken away anyway. I knew I was going to lose it anyway. It just had happened a little sooner than I thought. Job understands that stuff he had, how did he get it? Was it because he was such a great guy? It was given to him by grace, because God loved him. And so he understands that, and so at least for the time being, he's able to deal with that. The thing that we often do, though, is, it's healthy to try to accept our own struggles. The problem comes in when we try to do the same thing to other people. Oh, it's going to work out fine for them. It's okay. I got faith. But one of the points of the book of Job is that there is a lot of suffering and a lot of injustice in the world that goes unredeemed. There's a lot of people who suffer and struggle, and we just put it in a box someplace because we don't like to deal with it. We want to explain it away. We want to not see it. And most of us are very fortunate. Most of us spend more time worrying about losing what we've got instead of realizing that there's a lot of other people whose lives really stink a great deal of the time. And sometimes that gets in the way of us understanding the gospel. It gets in the way of us understanding what God is trying to teach us. Some of you probably remember this old TV show that was on back in the 70s called MASH. It's about these doctors and nurses who are in an army hospital in the middle of the Korean War. And it's about how hard it is for them to deal with things because they're devoted to healing people. And they're in the middle of this environment where everyone else is trying to kill each other. Well, there's this one episode where they run across this young pilot. This young pilot has had to bail out of his plane because it was going down, and he lands near their hospital, and so these doctors, they take him in and they check him over and they let him stay there a couple days to make sure he's okay before they send him back to flying again. He's a real nice guy, real friendly guy, so they like him and they get to know him a little bit. But when they start talking to him, they find out that he's a bomber pilot. That's his job. He gets in his plane, he drops bombs and goes back home. And he's talking about how, to him, he sees their camp and the squalor and the mess and all the wounded and bleeding soldiers and death. And he says, "Oh, I'm sure lucky I'm not down here. I got it great. You know, for me, the war is a cool thing because I got this great plane and I fly up in the sky and it's beautiful up there. And I just go out once a day, drop a bomb and go back home. And I even get to go home on weekends. The Army even lets me fly home on weekends. It's really great. And I'm really lucky." And so one time when they're kind of giving a little tour of their camp, they take him into the operating room. And one of the doctors is operating on this little Korean girl, young girl, maybe 6-7 years old. And the pilot looks at this young girl, her little body is all torn apart and bloody, and the doctor's desperately trying to stitch her back together. And he says, "Well, I thought you only treated soldiers here. What's she doing in here? What happened to her?" And he said, "Well, someone dropped a bomb on her village." Well, he starts to think about that a little bit. So he says, "Well, who dropped it? Was it one of ours or one of theirs?" And they tell him, "Well, they just dropped it. They didn't autograph it. You know, it's." And he says, "Well, can't we find out? Can't we find out whether it was one of ours or one of theirs? It's really important." And the doctor says, "It's not important to her." And so, and this guy, of course, he breaks at that, and he gets really angry at the doctors. He says, "Yeah, you deliberately showed me that, didn't you? Now you ruined things for me. Now I can never just enjoy going out and flying like I used to. Now I know what it does to people, and now I can't ever deny that. I can't ever get that out of my head." And they said, "Look, we really like you. We didn't do this because we don't like you. We think you're a great guy. It's just that no one should be involved in this horrible war without understanding what's really at stake. When you get insensitive about something like that, it's going to lead you to be insensitive about a lot of other stuff. You know, we understand you got your job to do. We're not condemning you, but you need to realize that the things that you're doing, this is the kind of thing that it causes. You probably still feel like you need to do your duty, but now you understand there's more to it than that." See, a lot of Christians are like that pilot. We're flying up high because we've got a blessed life, and we think that because we're so good, it's not going to get taken away. And when we read about bad things that happen, unless it's one of these media-designated tragedies, okay, everybody feel bad about this. Unless it's a media-designated tragedy, we don't think about it. We want to deny it. You know, we get all upset at some incident that we read about in a nice middle-class community where all of a sudden people die, but we don't realize that there's people who live in terror and violence every day. We tend to think that they did something to deserve it, but they didn't. It's just grace that we're here and they're there. We tend to be very outraged when young people in our society die of gunshots or violence, but our own country's policies around the world create a lot of death. They still do. It didn't end in Korea. There's still all these things that are going on, and whatever else our governments do, they all have that one thing in common. They all like to play general. And they all do things that they think they need to do because it makes us feel safer. It's what one of Bob Ward's favorite songwriters, Roger Waters, calls the bravery of being out of range. You know, that we can be very patriotic and very brave about things when the suffering goes on all the way over there to this squalid little country that God doesn't care about anyway, but God does care. And it's one of the things about Christianity that we do have to learn to come to grips with the fact that the world can be a very ugly place. It's not a lack of faith to ask God why. It's not a lack of faith to say, "God, why don't you do more about this?" It's a legitimate question. I know it's a question that shocks a part of your spirit, a part of your fleshly mind, just repels in horror at that. Like, we're not allowed to ask that question. That's for atheists. Atheists are supposed to do that. We're defensive about the fact that somehow people question God, and the book of Job challenges us, don't be so quick to answer. Before you start coming up with the answers to why it's so, step back and really come to grips with the fact that, you're right. This world can be an awful place. Little girls die from the bombs that I drop. So, Linda's giving me this, we have these signs. It means we need to move on. So we're going to move on. We'll see if we get time for some discussion a little bit later. I answer to a higher authority than the elders. I hope you realize that. Job chapter 2. Picking up here at the beginning of the chapter. Chapter 2, verse 1 to 6. Gloria, thank you very much for reading. You have a beautiful voice, and I love to hear you read. So you take verse 1 to 6. Verses 7 to 10. Frank, could you get that for us? And then I have saved verses 11 to 13 for Phil. Great. Thank you very much. We'll talk more about Phil's three friends there a little bit later on. Satan is still roaming the earth. Satan is still looking for people to accuse and hurt. When's he going to stop doing that? Not anytime soon, right? Not in our lifetimes. Not until Jesus comes back. How does he feel towards Job now? Does he feel sorry for him? Does he feel like Job's had enough? No. He's still filled with rage. He still hates. Still angry. So some of the times when we go through a lot and we wonder when it's going to end, well, when do you think Satan's going to feel that you've had enough? When do you think he's going to take pity on you? Well, basically never. Basically, to the limit of his ability, he will do harm to you no matter what. He doesn't have any self-control. Even when he had the chance to get Jesus on the cross, he did his worst, and in so doing, he was actually bringing about his own downfall. By being so cruel to Jesus on the cross, bringing about God's own plan. Satan still hates. It's interesting what God says here. He takes away another restriction on Satan, but God says something interesting. He says, he maintains his integrity, even though you incited me to ruin him without any reason. So this was just senseless. See, God doesn't say, oh, well, I feel okay about this because there's some great blessing I'm going to give Job that I couldn't have given him if I hadn't let this happen to him. He says there was no reason to let him suffer that. And you see, sometimes we look at this and say, it's like a test because God's proving Satan wrong. You know, God's winning here. Well, does Satan repent? Does Satan stop? Does Satan realize, okay, you're right, God, I'll stop accusing people? No. It's just purely letting Satan do his free will. And it's a side of God that's important for us to understand. Again, our fleshly mind just rebel against that God could allow this to happen and even say for no reason. But God accepts the responsibility for it. Because even though he didn't do anything, notice the pronoun here in verse 3. He says, you incited me to ruin him. God accepts the responsibility, even though he didn't bring it about. God accepts the fact that, yes, I allowed it to happen. And it's important for us not to just try to deny this and explain it away. It's a legitimate question when people ask, how can this loving God permit all these horrible things to happen? Now, you know the question that people always ask, it's a question that's been asked probably since long as there's been human beings. People always want to say, why do bad things happen to good people? Here, as my old friend Adrian Monk likes to say, here's the thing. That is not the right question. That is not a legitimate question. Because when we say they happen to good people, what are we doing? We're saying it's okay if it happens to those slime bags over there. The legitimate question is, why do bad things happen to people? Why does it happen to anybody? Because God loves everybody. God loves everybody no matter what you and I think about them. So the legitimate question is, why do things happen? Why do bad things happen, period? That's where you go back to that pilot in the plane. If something bad happens to him, he's upset about it. He drops a bomb and it kills some Korean girl. Well, he doesn't even notice it. Not that he thinks that she's bad, but that they're just beneath notice. We're outraged when something happens in a nice middle-class community, but we just assume that there's some really good reason when it happens in some squalid little country someplace. Never mind the fact that they've suffered all their lives and could really use a break, whereas we got it pretty good most of the time and ought to take some suffering in stride better than we do. This is what the point of this extreme suffering is going on. And so when Satan strikes again, this time he just takes away all comfort from Job. Satan just wants to take it all. Satan can't be satisfied. It's like those prolate spheroid exhibitions in the fall. When those games that a lot of you characters love, when the Buckeyes play, Southeastern Montana Barbers College, and they score all these touchdowns against some hapless foe. How do you feel when they beat one of those teams, like, maybe 21-10? It's like, oh, that's terrible. We only won by 11 points, so we should have crushed these guys. That's the way Satan feels towards us. And I'll let you think about the theological implications of that analogy. But that's the way that Satan feels. He's just never satisfied, and he's never satisfied with the pain and suffering that he caused. So Satan strikes again, and he takes away even the physical comfort that Job has. And here is where Job's friends come in. And it's interesting, we're going to see these guys a lot later, and later on, they're just going to go badly astray. They're going to say a lot of foolish things, and God's even going to come out of the sky and rebuke them. But right now, this is, as Winston Churchill would have said, their finest hour. Because what do? They just sit and comfort Job. They're just sitting with him because the situation speaks for itself. Anything that they would say right now would just be foolish.
Well, it's going to be okay, Job.
Lost everything you had and all your kids died. It's going to be okay. We've got faith in God. That would just sound silly. See, they know enough not to do that. It's like the Hippocratic Oath that doctors take. First, do no harm. They know, if nothing else, let's not make it worse by our ridiculous comments. Isn't that right, Wade? Did we get the Hippocratic Oath correct?
Right.
Good. See, it's handy keeping these doctors around, right? Once in a while, they come in useful. One of these days, we'll figure out what to do with all these engineers we're stuck with. The thing that they understand is that anything they say would just be silly, and so they're just with him. They're just showing their compassion, their concern. They're just as shocked and upset about it as he has. Now, the outline of Job, actually, when you go through the book, is actually based on their conversations with him. We're reading the introduction here in verse 1 to 3. These three guys are going to each start talking to Job. After Job shares his depression and his agony, they're going to start talking. And there's two full cycles of Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar talking to Job, then Job answers. And they start a third cycle, which gets interrupted. And this outline, by the way, is in your notes, so you don't have to scribble it down. There's two full cycles, chapters 4 to 21. Then there's a partial cycle that gets interrupted by another guy, Elihu, this younger guy who's sitting listening to this. And he decides he's tired of listening to all these guys talk because he's had all the answers all along. And he's been patiently waiting. So he jumps in. And it's after his speech that God decides that it's time to call an end to this endless chatter. And God gives his speech, which is kind of the climax of the book in chapters 38 to 41. And then there's a short epilogue. Now, the short epilogue is what people remember because God gives back Job a lot of his stuff, lets him have a lot of new wealth and new family and everything. And so sometimes people want to say, oh, well, it worked out great. It was fine. Just a little intellectual exercise for Job here. And it's exactly the kind of thing we tend to do with human suffering. Well, just one little thing. For those of you who are parents, if all your kids got killed today, but you got back the same number eventually, would you call it even? I don't think so. I'm not a parent, and I'm appalled at the very thought of that. It doesn't just work out great for Job. We can't just write the book of Job off as, oh, it just shows everything worked out great. It doesn't. The book of Job is not a little pat answer to things. The book of Job is a reminder life can get very painful, and as Christians, we're not called to deny it. We're not called to exploit it. We're not called to use it to show everybody that we're right and we have the solutions and they don't. We're there to sympathize with it, to try to redeem it, to try to heal when we have the chance. And we'll get into chapter 3 here, we don't have time to do too much, but we want to at least see what Job is feeling. It says, after this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. See, up till now, he's been handling this really well. But reality starts to set in. And he said, may the day of my birth perish, and the night it was said, a boy is born, that day may it turn to darkness. May God above not care about it. May no light shine upon it. May darkness and deep shadow claim it once more. May a cloud settle over it. May blackness overwhelm its light. That night may thick darkness seize it. May it not be included among the days of the year, nor be entered in any of the months. May that night be barren. May no shout of joy be heard in it. May those who curse days curse that day, those who are ready to rouse Leviathan. May its morning stars become dark, may it wait for daylight in vain and not see the first rays of dawn, for it did not shut the doors of the womb on me to hide trouble from my eyes. Reality is set in, and this is the kind of thing that when people start saying things like this, what's our tendency? Oh, you shouldn't say that. You're not supposed to say stuff like that. You should have a little faith here, Job. It's going to work out okay. This is the way that he really feels. You know, there's lots of psalms that express this kind of thought. The book of Jeremiah, the prophet Jeremiah frequently expresses this kind of thought. Jesus himself, when he was getting ready to go to the cross, was stricken with grief and horror at what was going to happen to him. It's not something that offends God. It's not something that angers God when we express our trouble and our anguish at how tough life can be, and certainly at how tough it can be for other people. There's nothing faithless about that. We're allowed to do that. You're allowed to be troubled by the things that go on in this world. There's some horrible things that go on. We're not called to deny it. We're called to sympathize with it, to heal it when we can, to try to understand. So listen to Job's emotions, not his literal words. The literal words in here actually are very interesting. The imagery that he uses. He says, why did I not perish at birth and die as I came from the womb? Why were there knees to receive me and breasts that I might be nursed? For now I would be lying down in peace. I would be asleep and at rest with kings and counselors of the earth who built for themselves palaces now lying in ruins, with rulers who had gold and filled their houses with silver. Or why was I not hidden in the ground like a stillborn child, like an infant who never saw the light of day? There the wicked cease from turmoil, and there the weary are at rest. Captives are also at ease, they no longer hear the slave driver's shout. The small and great are there, and the slave is freed from his master. It's interesting, he longs for what? Death. Because death would just be an end. It would just be a release from everything like this. But it's interesting, even when he's so depressed, and this imagery in this chapter is really graphic, and it actually, if you read a lot of philosophers, as I've expended a lot of my time and energy doing, it's actually a much more concise and eloquent statement of human struggle than a lot of the analytical stuff that they come up with. But you know, what's interesting, in his despair and desperation, he actually says some things that are quite profound. Now, some of his perspective is off in just begging for death, but his observations, some of them are very profound, because what does he say about death? What happens to us all when we die? We're all equal, aren't we? It's all the inequalities of this life disappear. All the injustices disappear. We're all at peace. We're all at rest. And what he's saying, it goes back to what he said at the end of chapter 1. Naked I came out of the womb, naked I will depart. He understands that we all are coming to that day anyway. And so to be so concerned about the things that happen temporarily in the world and the victories and losses that we endure, it shows a basic lack of perspective. Yeah, I read an article once from a magazine about they sent these reporters to several different, I think it was like 10 or 12 major world cities to interview people about what's your greatest fear. And they went to, you know, like London and Paris, and I think it was Sao Paulo, Brazil, and Mexico City, and Beijing, and Tokyo, and Moscow, and all these places. And they interviewed people in those cities. They had like a little list of things. Which of these do you fear the most? And they wrote this article in the magazine about the things that people around the world fear the most. Now, why did they do it? I don't know. Probably a bunch of reporters sat around and tried to figure out, how can we get our editor to pay for us to travel around the world at the magazine's expense? But they did it, and it was interesting, because almost all of them came out to be exactly the same thing. Almost all the places where they went, the two things that came up were death of a loved one or permanent physical disability or illness. Almost every place, it was one of those two, and the other one was second. All the cities except two. All of them were the same except for those two. Now, of course, it was a little bit different. You know, when you go to Paris and ask someone about their loved ones, it means something different than it means in the rest of the world. But most of it was they were either worried about loved ones dying or something, some permanent illness happening to themselves. There were only two exceptions of all these big world cities. When they went to Tokyo, there was a different answer. And it makes a lot of sense if you think about when we usually read about Japan in the news, what's usually happening? Usually an earthquake or a tsunami, or then every few years they have the odd Godzilla attack. You know, so that's what their fear was, natural disasters. That's what people in Tokyo lived in fear of, was natural disasters, and it makes perfect sense. Then they came to New York City, USA, USA. What was the greatest fear of people in the USA? Having to adjust to a lower standard of living. It's like that old Sesame Street song, one of these things is not like the others. One of these things just doesn't belong. Your child dying, going blind or losing a limb, a tsunami wiping out your village, having to drive a Chevy because you can't afford a Lexus. Which one shows a really terrible lack of perspective? USA, USA. That's the kind of thing that Job is meant to cure us of, to realize that a lot of things we call suffering, now Job really suffered, but a lot of things we call suffering are just really still being comparatively lucky, but not being able to appreciate it. So that's one of the lessons right there. Okay, I'm getting the old sign over here. Job ends his first speech by asking the question, why? And this is what we're going to talk about so much in Job. Why? And it's interesting, he doesn't blame God. Job is broken, but he's not faithless. Job just wants to make sense of it because he loves his relationship with God. He still has his relationship with God. And so all this stuff he's saying, this depression, it's not a sin. It's not faithless. I know you've heard, depression is a sin. I never get depressed. Well, if you never get depressed, what does that say about your lack of sensitivity? Because this world is full of depressing things. Just because we're like that pilot in the MASH show, flying above it all, enjoying the scenery, dropping a bomb without knowing what happens to the people underneath it, it doesn't mean everything else is great. And there's a lot of injustice and pain in the world that will never be redeemed. And it's not our calling to deny that. It's our calling to understand it and to try to fit that into a Christian perspective. Job says, why is light given to those in misery and life to the bitter of soul? To those who long for death that does not come, who search for it more than for hidden treasure, who are filled with gladness and rejoice when they reach the grave. Why is life given to a man whose way is hidden, whom God has hedged in? For sighing comes to me instead of food. My groans pour out like water. This is an interesting statement. What I feared has come upon me. It's interesting because remember at the beginning, what was the thing we saw Job doing? So I'm offering sacrifices. Why? To protect his kids, because he was worried that something might happen to them. Well, what he feared has come upon him. His wealth, even his relationship with God, did not make him exempt from suffering, from trials, because that's the kind of world that he lives in. And he says, I have no peace, no quietness, I have no rest, but only turmoil. So let's not condemn Job, because this is reality of life. You and I are never going to have this extreme experience, but we're going to go through some tough times and we're going to have good things. And as always, it's good when we look at pain as an aspect of life in this world, developing a spiritual perspective instead of a materialistic perspective or even a philosophical perspective. I make fun of engineers and doctors, and with very good reason, but even philosophers don't really get the real points of what's going on. You read philosophers, they're just as bad as engineers and doctors. They want to explain it all away or solve it all or fix it all, and they can't. When we look at Jesus' example, Jesus didn't try to deny the suffering in the world. He didn't try to control it. He didn't try to exploit it. He went around just doing what? When he met someone that was suffering that he could heal them, he healed them. But he didn't fix it all. When he left, there was still a lot of lepers, still a lot of poor people, still a lot of agony. But when he met someone face to face, what did he do? He did whatever he could. He didn't try to control it. He didn't even try to exploit it. It wasn't, oh, I can heal you that if you come and listen to this little 10 series of lessons I have on Bible studies, things that I want you to believe. He just healed it for the sake of healing it. You know, Romans 12 says, rejoice with those who rejoice and mourn with those who mourn. Life in the real world is a story of rejoicing and mourning. Your life is about that, and other people's lives are about that. And it's our calling as Christians not to rebel against that, but to realize that's the real world, rejoicing and mourning. And when we're with those who rejoice, sure, encourage them. Don't bog them down with criticisms or judgment. Let them enjoy what God has given them. When we're with people who are mourning and suffering, show the compassion. Don't just jump up, oh, I got a good answer to that. I heard a good lesson on that. Let them know, like Job's three friends in their finest hour here, hey, I'm really sorry. You're right, the world stinks. When atheists question, how can God let all this stuff happen? You think he's so loving. Instead of just, oh no, here's some great theological points I read. We learned a lot of stuff about this. Just say, yeah, you're right. It's a really troubling question, isn't it? The world can be a really rough place, and it's kind of a strange thing that God would allow that. It's a legitimate question. As the engineers always ask me, if I can only get one thing out of this class, what should I get? Well, get that it's legitimate to ask those questions. It's part of what Jesus meant when he said, we're going to have life to the full. Jesus lived life to the full, but it wasn't full of fun. Jesus experienced the best of this world and the worst of this world. We're going to experience the best of this world. See, the things that you get from God, we as Christians are able to enjoy them to an extent that the pagans are not, because we can accept them by grace. And we can learn not to cling to them and worry about losing them, just to appreciate what we've got in the here and now. And we can also learn, instead of being callous towards the suffering of the world, instead of trying to write it off, we can learn to try to redeem it, to try to show some genuine sympathy, because we've got the eternal security. See, it doesn't matter if atheists think that God is a bad God because he lets us suffering in the world. He's not going to cease to be God. They can't argue him out of being God. They can't call for an election to come up with a new God. God is there. He doesn't need us to defend him. He's called us to try to heal the sick and the suffering, to try to reach out to them and show compassion. And we can't do that unless we understand the legitimacy of the problem. Finish up with a trivia question. First trivia question of the year. Thought I'd break in with an easy one. This is movie trivia. Which one of actor Harrison Ford's movies was based on a novel called Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? This is a novel, which I know better than to ask you characters if you've read it. I hope maybe one or two of you did. It's a novel called Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? Well, what does that sound like? Which movie does that sound like? Does that sound like Raiders of the Lost Ark? Does it sound like Cowboys and Aliens? Does it sound like Star Wars? Does it sound like Return of the Jedi? Or does it sound like Blade Runner? Well, this novel is by Philip K. Dick. It's about a futuristic society in which they have a lot of androids, robots, to serve people's needs. What's happened, though, is technology has gotten so advanced that the androids are indistinguishable from human beings. And the androids were originally built to colonize Mars. But what's happened is that the androids are so human-like that they've taken on their own self-will. And a lot of them are sneaking back to Earth, and they're causing a lot of trouble. They're very amoral, and so they're causing a lot of problems. And so the main character in this story, which is played by Harrison Ford in the movie. He is a special agent appointed by the government to try to figure out who is a human and who is an android. And if you know these movies, that's the plot of Blade Runner. Blade Runner is the movie that this is based, or that was based on this story. Well, the thing about it is that the androids are so advanced that physically they're indistinguishable from human beings. You can't just cut one open because they're indistinguishable. The only way to tell physically would involve killing them, which you can't kill it in case it's a human being. So the way that the character in the story has to do it, they've designed a special series of psychological tests. Because the androids physically are identical to human beings, and they can simulate human emotions. They can pretend to be happy, they can make the facial expressions and the gestures and laugh, or they can cry and pretend to be upset about something, they can pretend to be concerned, but they don't really have the true emotions like human beings do. And so this test that they give them, it's a special test that they hook the androids, or suspected androids, up to these machines that measure the dilation of their capillaries in the face. And they have this thing that magnifies their eyes to see the reaction in their eyes. And then they describe a lot of horrible situations or shocking situations. They'll describe what would you do if you came home and you found your spouse committing infidelity with someone, and they gauge their reactions to see if it's just simulated or if it's real. What if you saw a person being mutilated and having their head cut off and blood spurting, and they see their reactions to see if they're just simulating it or if it's real. And that's the only way that they can tell is by whether their subtle little reactions can do that. And the point of it, at least in the movie, in the movie they put in a lot of gratuitous violence so people like Phil and Ray would buy tickets to see the movie. But in the book, the book is very philosophical, because the point of the book is that's the only thing that really distinguishes human beings from robots is your ability to empathize and sympathize and be disturbed by the unfair things of life. They actually have a clincher question in this movie. It's a dirty trick that he uses. He carries around this briefcase that's made with this real specially treated calves leather, but he uses it he tricks people. When there's a really tough android, what he'll do is he's got this really soft briefcase. He says, okay, that's done. He puts away his papers. He leaves them hooked up to the equipment. He said, look at this great briefcase I got. Feel how smooth that is. And when they got their hand out, he says, yeah, it was made from the skin of freshly killed babies. And if they don't immediately, it's a lie, but he's testing them. If they don't immediately repel in horrified shock, he knows they're an android, and he gets rid of them. And the point is that is an essential factor, even from a pagan point of view, it's an essential factor of our humanity to sympathize and empathize with suffering. And to understand that this world can be a cruel and unjust place. And as Christians, it's not less so, it's more so. As Christians, we're called to be more aware of just how desperate life in this world can be and not explain it away. That's a lesson in the opening chapters of Job, is to accept the legitimacy of these questions. Why does God give us good things and bad things at the same time? Why does he let all this suffering go on? Why does he let Satan himself have free will? For that matter, why are we here at all then, if this world is going to be such a tough place? You can't get the right answers unless you accept the legitimacy of the question. So, we deliberately did not answer anything. I'm sure that the engineers are going to complain and write letters of protest to the elders. But there's a time for the questions and there's a time for the answers. And you can't get the answers unless you let the questions really sink in and really understand what you're dealing with. Thank you so much for your patient attention. Only went over by like 3 or 4 minutes, so we're not too bad to start off. I'll try to get even better as we go along.